A puma at large. Pumas are large, cat-like animals which are found in America. When reports came into London Zoo that a wild puma had been spotted 45 miles south of London, they were not taken seriously. However, as the evidence began to accumulate, experts from the zoo felt obliged to investigate, for the descriptions given by people who claimed to have seen the puma were extraordinarily similar. The hunt for the puma began in a small village where a woman picking blackberries saw a large cat only 5 yards away from her. It immediately ran away when she saw it, and experts confirmed that a puma will not attack a human being unless it is cornered. The search proved difficult, for the puma was often observed at one place in the morning and at another place 20 miles away in the evening. Wherever it went, it left behind it a trail of dead deer and small animals like rabbits. Paw prints were seen in a number of places, and puma fur was found clinging to bushes. Several people complained of cat-like noises at night, and a businessman on a fishing trip saw the puma up a tree. The experts were now fully convinced that the animal was a puma, but where had it come from? As no pumas had been reported missing from any zoo in the country, this one must have been in the possession of a private collector and somehow managed to escape. The hunt went on for several weeks, but the puma was not caught. It is disturbing to think that a dangerous wild animal is still at large in the quiet countryside.
Passage 2, 13 equals 1. Our vicar is always raising money for one cause or another, but he has never managed to get enough money to have the church clock repaired. The big clock which used to strike the hours day and night was damaged during the war, and has been silent ever since. One night, however, our vicar woke up with a start. The clock was striking the hours. Looking at his watch, he saw that it was 1 o'clock, but the bell struck 13 times before it stopped. Armed with a torch, the vicar went up into the clock tower to see what was going on. In the torchlight, he caught sight of a figure whom he immediately recognized as Bill Wilkins, our local grocer. "Whatever are you doing up here, Bill?" asked the vicar in surprise. "I'm trying to repair the bell," answered Bill. "I've been coming up here night after night for weeks now. You see, I was hoping to give you a surprise." "You certainly did give me a surprise," said the vicar. "You've probably woken up everyone in the village as well. Still, I'm glad the bell is working again." "That's the trouble, vicar," answered Bill. "It's working all right. But I'm afraid that at 1 o'clock it will strike 13 times, and there's nothing I can do about it." "We'll get used to that, Bill," said the vicar. 13 is not as good as 1, but it's better than nothing. Now let's go downstairs and have a cup of tea."
Passage 3. An Unknown Goddess. Some time ago, an interesting discovery was made by archaeologists on the Aegean island of Kier. An American team explored a temple which stands in an ancient city on the promontory of Aia Irini. The city at one time must have been prosperous, for it enjoyed a high level of civilization. Houses, often 3 stories high, were built of stone. They had large rooms with beautifully decorated walls. The city was even equipped with a drainage system, for a great many clay pipes were found beneath the narrow streets. The temple which the archaeologist explored was used as a place of worship from the 15th century BC until Roman times. In the most sacred room of the temple, clay fragments of 15 statues were found. Each of these represented a goddess and had at one time been painted. The body of one statue was found among remains dating from the 15th century BC. Its missing head happened to be among remains of the 5th century BC. This head must have been found in classical times and carefully preserved. It was very old and precious even then. When the archaeologists reconstructed the fragments, they were amazed to find that the goddess turned out to be a very modern-looking woman. She stood 3 feet high, and her hands rested on her hips. She was wearing a full-length skirt which swept the ground. Despite her great age, she was very graceful indeed. But so far, the archaeologists have been unable to discover her identity.
Passage 4. The Double Life of Alfred Bloggs. These days, People who do manual work often receive far more money than clerks who work in offices. People who work in offices are frequently referred to as white-collar workers, for the simple reason that they usually wear a collar and tie to go to work. Such is human nature that a great many people are often willing to sacrifice higher pay for the privilege of becoming white-collar workers. This can give rise to curious situations, as it did in the case of Alfred Bloggs, who worked as a dustman for the Ellesmere Corporation. When he got married, Alf was too embarrassed to say anything to his wife about his job. He simply told her that he worked for the corporation. Every morning, he left home dressed in a fine black suit. He then changed into overalls and spent the next 8 hours as a dustman. Before returning home at night, he took a shower and changed back into his suit. Alf did this for over 2 years, and his fellow dustman kept his secret. Alf's wife has never discovered that she married a dustman, and she never will, for Alf has just found another job. He will soon be working in an office as a junior clerk. He will be earning only half as much as he used to, but he feels that his rise in status is well worth the loss of money. From now on, he will wear a suit all day, and others will call him Mr. Bloggs, not Alf.
Passage 5. The Facts. Editors of newspapers and magazines often go to extremes to provide their readers with unimportant facts and statistics. Last year, a journalist had been instructed by a well-known magazine to write an article on the president's palace in a new African republic. When the article arrived, the editor read the first sentence and then refused to publish it. The article began, "Hundreds of steps lead to the high wall which surrounds the president's palace." The editor at once sent the journalist a telegram, instructing him to find out the exact number of steps and the height of the wall. The journalist immediately set out to obtain these important facts, but he took a long time to send them. Meanwhile, the editor was getting impatient, for the magazine would soon go to press. He sent the journalist 2 urgent telegrams, but received no reply. He sent yet another telegram, informing the journalist that if he did not reply soon, he would be fired. When the journalist again failed to reply, the editor reluctantly published the article as it had originally been written. A week later, the editor at last received a telegram from the journalist. Not only had the poor man been arrested, but he had been sent to prison as well. However, he had at last been allowed to send a cable, in which he informed the editor that he had been arrested while counting the 1,084 steps leading to the 15-foot wall which surrounded the president's palace.
Passage 6. Smash and Grab. The expensive shops in a famous arcade near Piccadilly were just opening. At this time of the morning, the arcade was almost empty. Mr. Taylor, the owner of a jewelry shop, was admiring a new window display. 2 of his assistants had been working busily since 8 o'clock and had only just finished. Diamond necklaces and rings had been beautifully arranged on a background of black velvet. After gazing at the display for several minutes, Mr. Taylor went back into his shop. The silence was suddenly broken when a large car, with its headlights on and its horn blaring, roared down the arcade. It came to a stop outside the jeweler's. 1 man stayed at the wheel, while 2 others, with black stockings over their faces, jumped out and smashed the window of the shop with iron bars. While this was going on, Mr. Taylor was upstairs. He and his staff began throwing furniture out of the window. Chairs and tables went flying into the arcade. 1 of the thieves was struck by a heavy statue, but he was too busy helping himself to diamonds to notice any pain. The raid was all over in 3 minutes, for the men scrambled back into the car, and it moved off at a fantastic speed. Just as it was leaving, Mr. Taylor rushed out and ran after it, throwing ashtrays and vases, but it was impossible to stop the thieves. They had got away with thousands of pounds worth of diamonds.
Passage 7. Crazy. Children often have far more sense than their elders. This simple truth was demonstrated rather dramatically during a civil defense exercise in a small town in Canada. Most of the inhabitants were asked to take part in the exercise, during which they had to pretend that their city had been bombed. Air raid warnings were sounded, and thousands of people went into special air raid shelters. Doctors and nurses remained above ground, while police patrolled the streets in case anyone tried to leave the shelters too soon. The police did not have much to do because the citizens took the exercise seriously. They stayed underground for 20 minutes and waited for the siren to sound again. On leaving the air raid shelters, they saw that doctors and nurses were busy. A great many people had volunteered to act as casualties. Theatrical makeup and artificial blood had been used to make the injuries look realistic. A lot of people were lying dead in the streets. The living helped to carry the dead and wounded to special stations. A child of six was brought in by two adults. The child was supposed to be dead. With theatrical makeup on his face, he looked as if he had died of shock. Some people were so moved by the sight that they began to cry. However, the child suddenly sat up, and a doctor asked him to comment on his death. The child looked around for a moment and said, "I think they're all crazy."
Passage 8. A Famous Monastery. The Great St. Bernard Pass connects Switzerland to Italy. At 8,114 feet, it is the highest mountain pass in Europe. The famous monastery of St. Bernard, which was founded in the 11th century, lies about a mile away. For hundreds of years, St. Bernard dogs have saved the lives of travelers crossing the dangerous pass. These friendly dogs, which were first brought from Asia, were used as watchdogs even in Roman times. Now that a tunnel has been built through the mountains, the pass is less dangerous. But each year the dogs are still sent out into the snow whenever a traveller is in difficulty. Despite the new tunnel, there are still a few people who rashly attempt to cross the pass on foot. During the summer months, the monastery is very busy, for it is visited by thousands of people who cross the pass in cars. As there are so many people about, the dogs have to be kept in a special enclosure. In winter, however, life at the monastery is quite different. The temperature drops to minus 30 degrees, and very few people attempt to cross the pass. The monks prefer winter to summer, for they have more privacy. The dogs have greater freedom too, for they are allowed to wander outside their enclosure. The only regular visitors to the monastery in winter are parties of skiers who go there at Christmas and Easter. These young people, who love the peace of the mountains, always receive a warm welcome at St. Bernard's Monastery.
Passage 9. A Trip to Mars. By now, a rocket will have set off on its 350 million mile trip to Mars, and scientists must be waiting anxiously for the results. The rocket will be traveling for 9 months before it reaches the planet. It contains a number of scientific instruments, including a television camera. Any pictures that are taken will have to travel for 3 weeks before they reach the Earth. If the pictures are successful, they may solve a number of problems about Mars and provide information about the markings on its surface, which nearly 100 years ago, the astronomer Schiaparelli thought to be canals. It will be a long time before any landing on Mars can be attempted. This will only be possible when scientists have learnt a lot more about the atmosphere that surrounds the planet. If a satellite can one day be put into orbit round Mars, scientists will be able to find out a great deal. An interesting suggestion for measuring the atmosphere around Mars has been put forward. A rubber ball containing a radio transmitter could be dropped from a satellite so that it would fall towards the surface of the planet. The radio would signal the rate at which the ball was slowed down, and scientists would be able to calculate how dense the atmosphere is. It may even be possible to drop a capsule containing scientific instruments onto the planet's surface. Only when a great deal more information has been obtained will it be possible to plan a manned trip to Mars.
Passage 10. The Loss of the Titanic. The great ship Titanic sailed for New York from Southampton on April the 10th, 1912. She was carrying 1,316 passengers and a crew of 891. Even by modern standards, The 66,000-ton Titanic was a colossal ship. At that time, however, she was not only the largest ship that had ever been built, but was regarded as unsinkable, for she had 16 watertight compartments. Even if two of these were flooded, she would still be able to float. The tragic sinking of this great liner will always be remembered, for she went down on her first voyage with heavy loss of life. 4 days after setting out, while the Titanic was sailing across the icy waters of the North Atlantic, a huge iceberg was suddenly spotted by a lookout. After the alarm had been given, the great ship turned sharply to avoid a direct collision. The Titanic turned just in time, narrowly missing the immense wall of ice which rose over 100 feet out of the water beside her. Suddenly, there was a slight trembling sound from below, and the captain went down to see what had happened. The noise had been so faint that no one thought that the ship had been damaged. Below, the captain realized to his horror that the Titanic was sinking rapidly, for 5 of her 16 watertight compartments had already been flooded. The order to abandon ship was given, and hundreds of people plunged into the icy water. As there were not enough lifeboats for everybody, 1,500 lives were lost.
Passage 11. Not guilty. Going through the customs is a tiresome business. The strangest thing about it is that really honest people are often made to feel guilty. The hardened professional smuggler, on the other hand, is never troubled by such feelings, even if he has 500 gold watches hidden in his suitcase. When I returned from abroad recently, a particularly officious young customs officer clearly regarded me as a smuggler. "Have you anything to declare?" he asked, looking me in the eye. "No," I answered confidently. "Would you mind unlocking this suitcase, please?" "Not at all," I answered. The officer went through the case with great care. All the things I'd packed so carefully were soon in a dreadful mess. I felt sure I would never be able to close the case again. Suddenly, I saw the official's face light up. He had spotted a tiny bottle at the bottom of my case, and he pounced on it with delight. "Perfume, eh?" he asked sarcastically. "You should have declared that. Perfume is not exempt from import duty." "But it isn't perfume," I said. "It's hair oil." Then I added with a smile, "It's a strange mixture I make myself." As I expected, he did not believe me. "Try it," I said encouragingly. The officer unscrewed the cap and put the bottle to his nostrils. He was greeted by an unpleasant smell which convinced him that I was telling the truth. A few minutes later, I was able to hurry away with precious chalk marks on my baggage.
Passage 12. Life on a Desert Island. Most of us have formed an unrealistic picture of life on a desert island. We sometimes imagine a desert island to be a sort of paradise where the sun always shines. Life there is simple and good. Ripe fruit falls from the trees and you never have to work. The other side of the picture is quite the opposite. Life on a desert island is wretched. You either starve to death or live like Robinson Crusoe, waiting for a boat which never comes. Perhaps there is an element of truth in both these pictures, but few of us have had the opportunity to find out. Two men who recently spent 5 days on a coral island wished they had stayed there longer. They were taking a badly damaged boat from the Virgin Islands to Miami to have it repaired. During the journey, their boat began to sink. They quickly loaded a small rubber dinghy with food, matches, and tins of beer, and rowed for a few miles across the Caribbean until they arrived at a tiny coral island. There were hardly any trees on the island, and there was no water, but this did not prove to be a problem. The men collected rainwater in the rubber dinghy. As they had brought a spear gun with them, they had plenty to eat. They caught lobster and fish every day, and, as one of them put it, et like kings. When a passing tanker rescued them 5 days later, both men were genuinely sorry that they had to leave.
Passage 13. It's only me. After her husband had gone to work, Mrs. Richards sent her children to school and went upstairs to her bedroom. She was too excited to do any housework that morning, for in the evening she would be going to a fancy dress party with her husband. She intended to dress up as a ghost, and as she had made her costume the night before, she was impatient to try it on. Though the costume consisted only of a sheet, it was very effective. After putting it on, Mrs. Richards went downstairs. She wanted to find out whether it would be comfortable to wear. Just as Mrs. Richards was entering the dining room, there was a knock on the front door. She knew that it must be the baker. She had told him to come straight in, if ever she failed to open the door, and to leave the bread on the kitchen table. Not wanting to frighten the poor man, Mrs. Richards quickly hid in the small storeroom under the stairs. She heard the front door open, and heavy footsteps in the hall. Suddenly, the door of the storeroom was opened, and a man entered. Mrs. Richards realized that it must be the man from the electricity board who had come to read the meter. She tried to explain the situation, saying, "It's only me," but it was too late. The man let out a cry and jumped back several paces. When Mrs. Richards walked towards him, he fled, slamming the door behind him.
Passage 14. A Noble Gangster. There was a time when the owners of shops and businesses in Chicago had to pay large sums of money to gangsters in return for protection. If the money was not paid promptly, the gangsters would quickly put a man out of business by destroying his shop. Obtaining protection money is not a modern crime. As long ago as the 14th century, an Englishman, Sir John Hawkwood, made the remarkable discovery that people would rather pay large sums of money than have their life work destroyed by gangsters. 600 years ago, Sir John Hawkwood arrived in Italy with a band of soldiers and settled near Florence. He soon made a name for himself and came to be known to the Italians as Giovanni Acuto. Whenever the Italian city-states were at war with each other, Hawkwood used to hire his soldiers to princes who were willing to pay the high price he demanded. In times of peace, when business was bad, Hawkwood and his men would march into a city-state, and after burning down a few farms, would offer to go away if protection money was paid to them. Hawkwood made large sums of money in this way. In spite of this, the Italians regarded him as a sort of hero. When he died at the age of 80, the Florentines gave him a state funeral, and had a picture painted which was dedicated to the memory of the most valiant soldier and most notable leader, Signor Giovanni Acudoe.